And he's funny. Time for the show.
I grew up in Wisconsin, so I know what winter feels like. I grew up feeling at peace in the cold, frigid air. I feel at home when I feel the cold wind rush across my face in the winter. And what I have found to be true is sometimes faith feels like winter. Sometimes our relationship with church, the Bible, and God feels cold, distant, and dying. I know what winter faith feels like because I've experienced it. Personally, I have doubted the goodness of God and the power of God, or the lack of it. I have questioned the death of loved ones. I have questioned my own near-death experience. I have cried out to God thinking I'm going to die because of the physical pain in my body. Professionally, I work as a hospital and hospice chaplain, and I see death daily and how it affects people and families, faith. But winter faith is not about the pain of death only. Winter faith is about doubt, emotional pain, grief, loss, spiritual pain of not having the answers. I used to run away from my winter faith, but now I embrace it. Winter faith has become my new home. So I created the Winter Faith Podcast. The Winter Faith Podcast believes all people have seasons of winter faith, and that doubt is essential in the journey of faith. This podcast embraces God, grief, pain, loss, emotional growth. So, will you join me on this journey? Do you have winter faith? Let's get into it. My name is Andy, and I have winter faith. With my new friend Mallory. We both graduated from Church of Christ seminaries, even though they would never use that word. So Mallory, tell us a little bit about yourself for people that don't know who you are, a little bit of I guess your like professional background, and you know, if you want to say a little bit about, you know, who you are personally, and then we'll get into talking a little bit about the content of your book as well. So thanks for being here.
Sure. Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation. So the first thing I usually say about myself is that I'm a Floridian. This is the place that made me, and the water and the sand are in my bones. And I my cells vibrate at a different frequency when I'm here and I'm around the water. So that is a big part of me. I can speak a little bit about my story, and of course there's different ways to frame that, but one of the ways I think about it is just kind of the various iterations of myself and various iterations of faith. So, grew up in a really loving and safe home, and in a faith tradition that also at that time felt really safe for me. It gave me enough of a space, you know, to begin to grow and to thrive, until it didn't. And then I needed to kind of push beyond that. And that really has been kind of the story from there forward. And so from there, even up till this point, I have found myself formed in a number of denominations and traditions and communities and spaces. And so I even, you know, people often ask, you know, the question of like, what denomination are you? And I use this phrase of like, well, I've been pretty denominationally promiscuous because I like, I just have engaged them all and said, like, what do you have to teach me? But one of the things that's really afforded me, even at an early age, I think, was this awareness that every community, every tradition, every story has something to offer. In some way, they point to and highlight truth and beauty, the divine. And every community, every tradition, every story also eclipses truth and hides it and even hinders it. And that has been true in any space that I've been in. And so again, from an early age, it just allowed me to not it, it took away the option in my mind of like, I'm going to find the one right place. And then that also then I think has helped inform my sense that I'll never get to the point where I go, I have found and figured out the truth fully, right? Like now I have finally gotten it. And so that has allowed for and formed this really evolving sense of faith, of self, that I write about in the book. And, you know, we can talk more about that. But professionally speaking, my career has really been between the nonprofit world and the academy. So this mix of doing nonprofit work in various ways, working in residential facilities for women who survived various forms of trauma, most often sexualized trauma. I helped to run an organization working to combat Islamophobia in Nashville. I'm now part of an organization doing global peacemaking work. And also in and outside of those times, you know, teaching at the university or different in undergrad courses, as well as training spiritual directors. I am a spiritual director. And so that's also part of my work is hosting space for people to bring their souls into speech and to do so in a really safe and non-judgmental space. And so part of my teaching is in training folks to become certified directors as well. So it really has carried both of those pieces, and it's always taken different forms, but the two things that have always remained true for me, no matter the form that my work has taken, I've always had this clear sense that I am a communicator and I am a holder of space.
That's beautiful. Do you think this idea of like holding space is kind of new? I talked to other counselors or spiritual directors that actually some of them that went to the same school you went to. And that, I just feel like that idea is not something I heard growing up in church, but I feel like it's really important.
I don't think the concept is new at all. I think that particular way of languaging it is new within some circles, certainly, and there is a stronger emphasis on it. But similarly, you know, that was not language that I was familiar with in my earliest years. But even just looking within the Christian tradition, which is certainly just one among many, you have numerous examples, particularly I think of the Desert Mothers and Fathers and the various practices where they would hold and host space for each other and allow space for the person that they were, you know, in community with to share about ways they were sensing spirit move within them, the questions they were asking, and so forth. And so that tradition, I think, carries on. And that's really where you see then spiritual direction kind of take this more formalized notion later on. But those are ultimately the roots. I think part of why it was not as widely practiced, at least in the traditions that shaped me at an early age, when you are taught to not trust yourself, when you are taught that you can't trust your feelings, your thoughts, your emotions, when you're taught that really you're not worth all that much, except for this, you know, absurd love of God that happens to find you worthy somehow, but really you're not much more valuable than a worm. What would be the point of asking somebody to share what it is that they're holding, what is it they're thinking, what it is they're questioning? Because all authority is external. Therefore, I don't need to listen somebody into their free speech. I need to tell them what is true, what is right, what they should be thinking and feeling. And it's truth is dictated to folks oftentimes in religious spaces.
Yes.
That's very different than what it looks like when I sit down as a spiritual director with no agenda, with no intent to move someone from A to B, but rather to host a space wherein they are free to name whatever it is they're holding, thinking, feeling, questioning, wondering, or not, and simply companion them in that space. That looks very differently, but my fundamental assumptions also need to look different to inform that space. If, you know, if I have that theology that I described earlier, this really low anthropology, then I'm not going to be able to sit with somebody in that way.
So that's a good academic way of saying it. The low view of anthropology, or you know, I guess the traditional way is just like the what's the term that was always said? I'm going blank. But that idea that is just so rampant that, you know, man is evil. And I'm wondering, like, your
Like I talk a lot about like winter faith and winter moments of like, I think it's, I guess using that language, I think it's really important to like recognize, like you just said, I had this very low view of myself. So therefore my space like didn't matter. And then if you think about even my assumption or more than assumption, like basically my experience is like women in Christian circles have even a like lower amount of space that is kept for them. I guess when you think of what I would call like winter faith moments, like in trying to hold space for the people in those moments, or for you personally, have you had those like moments? And I define winter faith as like when it's when God feels like distant, when your faith feels dark and cold and God feels like he's not there, or God's not there, not necessarily he, but and then how that I feel like maybe goes into a little bit of what your book talks about.
Yeah, this is one of the things I love most about my work as a spiritual director is that, again, it's the space for folks to bring whatever it is that they're naming and holding. And part of why I even set out to begin offering that is because I desperately needed spaces like that and just couldn't find them. And in a particular season of significant, you know, deconstruction and reorientation of self and faith, I really needed folks with whom I could safely question, doubt, lament, rage, cry, whatever, who were not afraid of the things that I was saying or asking or wondering about. And it was just very hard to find those spaces or those relationships. You would say something and you could immediately see that look on someone's face that says, oh no, now I'm worried about you. And not in a like, I want to come alongside you as a friend, but like, I need to figure out how to make sure that you get back to the right place. And I just refuse to engage in that any longer. And
can you name one example? Sorry to interrupt, but like, is there one example you can name of something you said and people were like, whoa, like.
I don't think about it in terms of specific examples. It could be anything to, you know, you ask questions about your assumptions around texts, sacred texts, and how they function, and what we assume about them, and what we can know of truth through them, even our assumptions about what truth even means. I mean, it's just you to start digging at the layers, or if you've always been given this one way of understanding a particular text, and then all of a sudden you hear it read through the lens of a different community or folks whose embodiment is different than yours, and suddenly it's cast into an entirely different relief, that can feel threatening to folks who were the ones who already told you, you know, this is the way that we understand the truth here. This is what this means, right? The one thing it means forever and always. And so I really needed space that was just free and safe that I could say whatever and question whatever. And again, it was really hard to find. So I just set out to create those spaces for other people as I still then sought to find them where I could. And, you know, as I'm training spiritual directors, the thing that I always tell them, and we talk through all the principles and the mechanics, and they work really hard to be formed into the type of people that can hold that type of space. But the thing I tell them is that of all the things that someone could say about you, the most important would be, I could sit with this person and I knew I could say anything, and it was safe enough to do that. And that's the kind of space I want to hold for somebody, so that whatever season they're in, whether it's one like you describe of this winter faith where it's, you know, I've not sensed God move in my life in any real tangible way in 10 years. Okay. That's what's real. The only thing I want to hear from somebody is what's actually real and true for them. Because to me, that's ultimately what spirituality is. It's just about the really real and the really true, truly true. Yeah. So if that's what's present, okay, then that's what we explore here. And we do so in a non-anxious way. And I love that a space like spiritual direction allows me to do that, because in other roles, it might feel a little more difficult to lean back in that. In other roles, I might feel like, oh, I'm supposed to be providing an answer, or I'm supposed to be guiding them from one step to the next. And literally those options don't exist in my work as a spiritual director. And so I'm really grateful for those spaces. And then also for when they are held for me.
So when space is held for you, what happens for you?
I self-edit a whole lot internally, right? I begin to have a feeling or a thought or a desire, and pretty quickly I can judge the hell out of that thing. I can say, no, that's not worth bringing up, or who are you to do that thing? No, stay small, right? I write about this in my book, like all the internal voices and pressures that have sought to keep me small as a response to trauma. And then when you combine those with the external pressures that are also doing the same to try to keep you small, and certainly that has been my experience as a woman and as a woman in Christian religious circles, it's really easy to go small, to stay there. And so if I'm even going to risk saying something, I'll often if I'm going to externalize it, I'll often do it really quickly, because it's almost like I'm trying to take up as little space as possible. So if I'm even going to take the risk to say it, let me do it as fast as I can. If I sit with somebody who just is comfortable with the silence, and they're not in a rush to make a counterpoint, they're not in a rush to convince me of anything, then I exhale, I relax, I actually allow myself the time to connect with what I'm really feeling and thinking and wondering about, to articulate that even to myself as I'm then doing so to another person, and to feel that that's being held with me, not for me, but with me, you know, by this other human being. That there's nothing like that, because it's very uncommon to find that space. Even if you're talking to a friend about things, which of course I'm so grateful for friends, but they're invested in me and in particular outcomes because they want my best. And so they show up a bit differently than a director or a therapist is going to. So I'm not trying to say one is better than the other. It's just to say, here are some of the particulars about these types of conversations, and why, particularly because of my impulses and the ways I've been conditioned to stay small and quiet, I desperately need spaces where there's time, there's room for me to bring my soul into speech.
Yeah. So when you, let's talk a little bit like specifically about your book. Like, how would you describe your book and what it is and what you're trying to accomplish with it?
So I've talked a little bit already about the ways that I've gone small in my life. Yeah. And as I spent time exploring that, I began to think about the ways that we have forced God to be small, namely in the ways that we have often in the Christian tradition, and certainly beyond that, had very narrowed and truncated ways of thinking about the divine, often solely through masculine language and imagery and metaphors for God. And so I explore that in the book, and how and why we even ended up with that being so. I talk about the implications of that, what that, you know, if that's true of God, what does that say about humanity and so forth? And then I offer this collection of distinctly feminine imagery and metaphor and languages for the divine, language for the divine, that has been essential for me to remain tethered to any sort of faith or spirituality, and has been really deeply healing and empowering for me. And so I talk about, I mean, it is a very personal and in some ways autobiographical exploration. And what I say in the book is that ultimately for me, everything that we believe to be true about God necessarily informs what we believe to be true about everything and everyone else. And so if the divine only takes one form, if the divine is only ever male, we are necessarily saying what we believe to be true about human beings and who or what gets to reflect the divine and who doesn't, who gets access to power and authority and who doesn't, who gets voice and space and who doesn't. So really, to me, that's the crux of the conversation, and why I think this isn't a side issue. This isn't a side conversation to be having. This is essential if we are to speak about humans and speak about God appropriately, and if we are to order our world in equitable and just ways.
And how, I guess, how did writing the book, I guess, shape your own view of yourself? And I would think that, right, even you said like autobiographical. Like it's something that I would think it did to you. Like you had this urge to write. Now it's actually out there. Like what's that feel like?
Mm-hmm. There's so many different pieces. I mean, there's just, as you can imagine, the vulnerability of just naming the pieces of my story that have brought me the most shame. And now I'm putting them in written form for others to explore. So there's that piece. There's a vulnerability of anytime you create anything and now you're inviting other people to engage it and critique it. And certainly that's happened. Some of those expected pieces. I think part of what was so profound for me in the experience of writing this book, and I was reflecting on this with another author recently, while I was writing the book, I really had to frequently practice this sense of going within and listening to my own self and believing spirit within me. Because as I'm writing, I would have these impulses that said, this isn't academic enough. This isn't scholarly enough. This doesn't sound smart enough. It's not impressive enough. You need to write it in a different way. This needs to look more like your dissertation than it does now. And so then I would think, oh, okay, shoot, I'm going the wrong direction. I need to be something else. And fortunately, in my best moments, I would take time to pause and to actually sense into what within me is seeking expression. What form does it want to take? And to listen to that, because that's a connection with true self. That's a connection with the divine for me. That's very different than those other voices that have all of their own ways of seeking to protect me, but also therefore to limit me and to keep me small. And instead tap into this incredible wealth of wisdom and truth that's within me that says, yeah, but that's not the book that wants to be written. That's not the piece that wants to come through me. Here's the form that this book wants to take. So I would literally sit and ask not only myself questions, I would ask the book questions. I would, if I was stuck on a chapter, I would say, what do you want to become? And I would listen and I would write it down. And that was such a helpful practice, because then throughout the book, if I would have those moments of self-doubt or I would hear voices, you know, telling me, well, think about this or do that. And, you know, often well-intentioned, but it's still an external voice. I would pause and go internal. I would reflect back on those journal entries where I'm like, okay, wait, you know, book, you told me what you wanted to be named. You told me the form that you wanted to take. And now I'm looking back, oh, right, this is what you want to be true about you. And I would use start from there and filter everything else through that as opposed to the inverse. That I try to engage that type of practice in whatever I'm doing, but it took a particular form when I was writing the book that remains really empowering for me. And one, I want to keep engaging and keep practicing whatever the thing is that I'm creating or doing.
So you also have, you just told me, I don't know if this is breaking news, but you created a podcast with it. So you tell us about the podcast and is it already out?
Yeah. So just last week, I launched the first episode, and basically when I was writing the book, I kept thinking, I just really want to have conversations with people about this. And, you know, writing can be quite solitary. And I just thought, I just want to be in a room and talk with people about these conversations. So I decided as a way, as a means of moving toward that end, to create this podcast. So it's a limited run, 16 episodes, basically an episode per chapter, where I'm bringing on a conversation partner, and together we're exploring how that the material of that chapter interfaces with their lives, with their embodiment, with their faith, with their own sense of self and the divine. And it's just been so fun. It's been a really lovely experience. And even like I just described, you know, that practice of going internal, I had all sorts of input about things I could do to try to promote the book, and I'm listening, right? It's not like I close my ears to that. And then I pause and I went internal. I'm like, but what do I want to do? And what do I want to invest in? And this project became very clear. And that was really just a couple months ago. And then it was like, you know, here we are and it's underway. And man, they've been really incredible conversations, and I'm thrilled to get to share with folks. So the podcast is called In the Waves, and folks can find it wherever they listen to podcasts.
Awesome. Awesome. And I'm assuming we can buy your book wherever books are.
That's right. That's right. Yep.
The book is called God Is.
Yes.
And I really enjoyed it. I'm going to go back and read parts of it again. I'm going to have my wife read it as well. I think she's really going to enjoy it. I guess my last, I guess I have two more questions, but first question is, what was your, do you have like a favorite part of the book, a favorite chapter, or a favorite page?
Goodness. You know, I could probably answer that in different ways. One of the ways I think about it is there's one line that every time I read it, it still makes me cry because I remember the exact moment where I had the encounter that I'm describing. So it's the end of the God is Creator chapter. And I talk about this kind of meditation of seeing God as creator. And I describe how she showed up and what she looked like. And she's in this pottery shed. And I use some themes of pottery in that chapter to kind of talk about this image of creator. And I remember having this conversation with her where I'm watching her and I'm just said, I want to be like you. And she turned to me and said, you are.
Wow.
And it was this beautiful moment.
Yeah.
So even when I wrote it and then anytime I read it, or if I talk about it with folks, it's like instantly it brings me back to that moment where I'm not theorizing about anything. I'm talking about a literal embodied experience with the divine and the way that she's shown up in my life and in really beautiful and healing ways.
That's beautiful. I think we should just end on that. That is really beautiful. And I'm definitely going to promote your book and your podcast. That sounds like a great way to kind of build on what you're doing for your next book too. So.
Yeah. Thanks for that positivity. I appreciate that.